Hi, Dave Emery here. Side one of For the Record program number 793, titled Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This program is being recorded on May 18th of the year 2014. Before beginning, let me remind you emphatically of the SpitfireList.com website that has all of my work over I'm in my 35th year on the air. It has all of my written and recorded work available for download for free, as well as articles by a brilliant and productive contributing editor, and also a small library of anti-fascist books, old anti-fascist books on easy-to-use PDF files. Again, all of that is available for download for free at SpitfireList.com. And the material on that website will be particularly important for this program, which, as the title indicates, is going to be updating a number of stories and also presenting information as well. And much of what will be in this program is a posit to material that has already been recorded, as will be the very first two stories that we deal with. In For the Record program number 791, titled They May Not Know Art, But They Know What They Like, we dealt with a working hypothesis that was set forth in very detailed fashion by Simon Dunstan, last name D-U-N-S-T-A-N, and Gerard Williams, just like in Williams, W-I-L-L-I-A-M-S. Their book is titled Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. And the two authors, whose academic and professional credentials are most impressive, they began by investigating what they frankly considered to be a conspiracy theory, namely the notion that Adolf Hitler had escaped at the end of World War II. By the end of their investigation some years later, they had become basically convinced of the accuracy of that conspiracy theory, namely that Adolf Hitler had escaped at the end of World War II and that his, quote, suicide and that of Eva Braun had been faked. What is significant about their working hypothesis could be summed up in one word, context, because it is not in and of itself the escape of Adolf Hitler, whose basic role was as crowd pleaser and as sort of a front man for some very, very powerful corporate interests in Germany, which were in turn inextricably linked and empowered by, to a considerable extent, corporate entities in the West, primarily the United States and Britain, mostly the U.S. And in the context of Adolf Hitler's escape, the two principal people who affected this on the Allied side, a name very well known to veteran listeners, that of Alan Dulles, an attorney for the powerful Wall Street white shoe law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, along with his brother John Foster Dulles. Alan Dulles became the chief European representative of the, of the Office of Strategic Services, or OSS. That was the American World War II Intelligence Service and the precursor of the CIA, which Alan Dulles went on to head. Eventually, he was dismissed by John F. Kennedy for lying to him about the Bay of Pigs and then served on the Warren Commission, which covered up JFK's assassination. On the Axis side, the key figure was Martin Bormann, about whom we had spoken at great length. Bormann was the real power behind the throne, so to speak, in Nazi Germany. He was sort of the eminence grise, the gray eminence behind Adolf Hitler. He mastered the Nazi bureaucracy and was involved with secreting Nazi assets abroad to perpetuate corporate Germany and what I have termed the Underground Reich, which he did so successfully in the post-war years. The authors utilize the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning at considerable length, and they obviously view it as having great credibility. The negotiation, what the authors termed a Faustian deal that was at the core of their working hypothesis, was a quid pro quo. Hitler and Martin Bormann and some of the other top Nazis would be allowed to escape Europe in exchange for, first of all, transferring much of the Nazi military technology and the technicians and scientists involved with developing it to the West. That has become better known as Project Paperclip, the best known but by no means the only experts who were so transferred were SS Officer Werner von Braun and also Walter Dornberger, head the military commander of Peenemünde Nordhausen. Here in the Silicon Valley, a guy named Arthur Rudolph, also a key Nazi operative, was also very much involved with the U.S. space program. There were many other Nazi scientists involved. Many of them were criminals of the First Order. In addition to the technology and the scientists and technicians involved with Project Paperclip, the other main transfer, so to speak, in this quid pro quo was art. The entire artistic heritage of Europe, which had been systematically looted by the Nazis. Much of it was turned into liquid capital, but most of it was kept initially for inclusion in the Führermuseum. That was a gigantic art museum that had been pictured or envisioned by failed artist Adolf Hitler. The creme de la creme, so to speak, of Western art was to have been housed in this Führermuseum in Linz, L-I-N-Z, Austria. That museum was never realized. Most of the art that was looted and ultimately was part of the quid pro quo transferred to the West under the deal hypothesized and to a considerable extent documented by the authors. That was originally art that was envisioned for the Führermuseum. The authors point out that relatively soon, in addition to the lavish eyewitness anecdotal evidence about Hitler's escape, there is also a fair amount of journalistic discussion at the time of Hitler's alleged escape. Very recently, FBI files alleging contacts that had seen Adolf Hitler or knew of his whereabouts in southern Argentina after the war has been declassified. There are still thousands of documents on both sides of the Atlantic about Hitler's alleged escape and presence in Latin America that remain classified almost three quarters of a century after the end of World War II. The question, of course, is why? Why are they classified? The authors point out, and again, this is covered at length and in detail, in For the Record 791 and at greater length and in greater detail in the book Grey Wolf, The Escape of Adolf Hitler. They point out that, by the way, one of the things that was in the quid pro quo was a deliberate disinformation campaign that the Third Reich had successfully engaged in which it was made out that they had developed the capability of firing submarine-launched V-1 cruise missiles tipped with deadly nerve gas and could hit the east coast of the United States, including New York City and other major cities on the American east coast, with these V-1s tipped with nerve gas. The authors maintain that a picket line, so to speak, of advanced U-boats in the Atlantic and southern Atlantic was deployed to give credibility to this potential threat. And again, that was called off in exchange for the escape of Hitler and the transfer to the West of the artwork and the Project Paperclip technicians and technology. That was part of Aktion Feuerland, the deal between Dulles and Bormann. Some of the submarines that were deployed and which gave credibility to the Nazi disinformation effort were later broken off and picked up, according to the author's working hypothesis, picked up Hitler and others in the Canary Islands, where they had fled in two legs of an airplane escape, and then they were then transferred to southern Argentina. The authors point out that essentially shortly after their escape, Hitler became essentially a marginalized figure and something of an artifact, because essentially his role was as crowd pleaser, and the people like Martin Bormann and Heinrich Müller became the main functionaries, the main pivot points of the post-war Nazi underground, what I call the Underground Reich, in Argentina. In the second part of, for the record, 791, we dealt with the curious case of Cornelius Gurlitt. That's a fellow named G-U-R-L-I-T-T, a very mysterious individual who had a gigantic collection of looted Nazi art. Very mysteriously, he was allowed, his father rather, Hildebrand Gurlitt, was allowed to go his way unmolested, despite the fact that he was obviously a key procurer of Nazi art. Cornelius Gurlitt, his son, was somehow able to fly beneath the official radar in Germany and elsewhere, despite the fact that his art collection was valued at something like $1.35 billion. Cornelius Gurlitt wasn't even registered with the police of Munich, Germany. That is extraordinary because every person in Germany has to be registered with the police. If you move from Berlin to, say, Munich, you have to deregister yourself with the Berlin police and register yourself with the Munich police when you make the move. The fact that Cornelius Gurlitt, who had an art collection worth more than $1 billion, the fact that he didn't even appear on the radar of German officialdom is extremely suspicious. His art collection was uncovered in early 2012. That was not made public till late 2013, which also raises some very serious questions. In that story, the many articles that we looked at in connection with Hildebrand the Elder and his son Cornelius Gurlitt, it emerged that Hildebrand Gurlitt was a major procurer of art for Adolf Hitler. 2 days after that program was recorded, Cornelius Gurlitt, the son, died at the age of 81. A couple of things emerged that I had not seen at the time. One, Cornelius Gurlitt, the elder Gurlitt, Hildebrand Gurlitt, had actually been tapped, according to an article on the obituary in the Wall Street Journal for his son Cornelius. Hildebrand Gurlitt had actually been tabbed by Adolf Hitler to head up the Führer Museum in Linz, Austria, and most of the looted art that was part of the quid pro quo between Dulles and Bormann, according to Dunstan and Williams, was originally intended for the Führer Museum. I would note, too, as we will see in the BBC article, that about a month before he died, Cornelius Gurlitt had his art collection returned to him. He then willed the entire collection, again worth something like $1.35 billion, that's B as in billion, to the Bern, Switzerland Art Museum, with which he had had no previous relationship. Switzerland is, of course, a lean, mean money laundering machine and was the locus of much of the looted wealth of the Third Reich and a major vehicle for international financial transactions for the Third Reich prior to, during, and after World War II. Many other miscreants also have used Switzerland to launder money. It also emerged in the wake of Cornelius Gurlitt's death. Again, he died 2 days after, for the record, 791 was recorded. It emerged that he also, Cornelius, that is, had an apartment in Salzburg, Austria, at which he also had a bunch of art stashed. And again, the notion that the authorities in Germany had no official record of this guy's existence is, it raises more questions than it answered. The two stories in question, the obituary in the Wall Street Journal of May 6th of 2014, an article by Mary M. Lane, L-A-N-E, German art collector in Nazi loot uproar dies at 81. It reads in part, Cornelius Gurlitt, G-U-R-L-I-T-T, the octogenarian son of one of Adolf Hitler's major art dealers, died in his Munich home on Tuesday morning, leaving the fate of his roughly 1,400 artworks unclear. Legal questions now swarm surrounding how and even if looted works in the collection can now be restituted to Holocaust victims and their heirs. Skipping down. It is unclear how the works ended up in the collection of Mr. Gurlitt's father, Hildebrand, a successful Nazi-era dealer whom Adolf Hitler had tapped to lead his unrealized Führer Museum in Linz, Austria, after the war. And again, as we looked at in 791, most of the art in the quid pro quo deal to allow Hitler to escape, according to Dunstan and Williams, was art that had been intended for the Führer Museum. Skipping down. Last month, tax authorities announced they would return Mr. Gurlitt's artwork to him. And then conveniently a month later, he died. The following is from the BBC News of May 7th of 2014. Nazi art hoarder Gurlitt makes Swiss Museum sole heir. It reads in part, German Nazi art hoarder Cornelius Gurlitt, who died on Tuesday, has made the Bern Art Museum in Switzerland his, quote, sole heir, unquote. The recluse's son of Adolf Hitler's art dealer is estimated to have amassed a collection worth up to €1 billion. The museum said the news struck, quote, like a bolt from the blue, unquote, given that it had no previous relationship with Mr. Gurlitt, unquote. Skipping down. Investigators found more than 1,400 works in Cornelius Gurlitt's flat in Munich in February of 2012, though they only revealed that discovery in late 2013, and a further 60 works of art in his house near Salzburg, Austria, earlier this year. And again, the notion that an individual who had so much wealth could have sort of slipped through the cracks is simply not credible on its surface. The Germans are a very thorough, detailed, and foresighted people. They are not like Sergeant Schultz in Hogan's Heroes. And the notion that something that ridiculous could have taken place is just not credible. Again, the Germans aren't a bunch of dummkopfs. Americans are a bunch of dummkopfs. The Germans are not. Another story that broke in the news recently was the shooting in April, the fatal shooting in April, of three ironically non-Jewish people at a Jewish community center and a Jewish retiree home in Kansas. Those killings allegedly by a fellow named Frazier Glenn Miller. He also uses the name Glenn Miller. Garnered quite a bit of attention in April. Then, of course, they became, the story was submerged. What we're going to look at in a series of stories, first of all, is the fact that Frazier Glenn Miller had very strong links to a fellow named Joseph Paul Franklin. He also was linked to The Order, a neo-Nazi group that was inspired by the Turner Diaries and apparently financed in part in addition to loot that they got from armored car robberies by, quote, German families, unquote, in Latin America. We're also going to take a look at the use of books by the National Vanguard and the National Alliance to inspire just this sort of leaderless resistance. And of course, as we looked at in For the Record 754 and in numerous posts, Glenn Greenwald, currently garnering hosannas as a journalist, as a lawyer, was a Nazi fellow traveler and specifically devoted quite a bit of effort pro bono to seeing to it that various Nazi groups and murderous Nazi foot soldiers of those groups would not face civic litigation for propagating their will that acts such as those propagated by the Order and others were actualized. Very quickly reviewing some information that we looked at in 754 from the History Commons website. 1988, neo-Nazi group founds publishing house, publishes book to inspire white assassins. And skipping down, speaking of William Luther Pierce, the head of the National Alliance, one of Glenn Greenwald's clients, and the author of the Turner Diaries and also another book, Hunter, he dedicates Hunter to Joseph Paul Franklin, convicted of the sniper murders of two African-American men. Pierce will later tell his biographer that he specifically wrote Hunter as a deliberate motivational tool for assassins, saying, quote, "From the beginning with Hunter, I had this idea of how fiction can work as a teaching tool in mind." Very quickly about the order before we get back to Fraser, Glenn Miller, and Joseph Paul Franklin, to whom Hunter was dedicated by William Luther Pierce, from the Google Books version or edition of Brotherhood and Murder by Thomas Martinez, a turncoat from the order. Some, quote, "Some very old German families in South America were giving Bob Matthews, leader of the order, some money." And skipping down, for example, as long ago as 1978, Manfred Rader, who headed the remnants of the German Nazi Party, traveled to Brazil, parenthetically, where Glenn Greenwald lives, where he met with Josef Mengele and other Nazi leaders. Immediately afterward, Rader traveled to the U.S., where he met with Dr. William Luther Pierce, the head of the National Alliance, among others. And again, it was the Turner Diaries that inspired the order. Now, more about Fraser, Glenn Miller, and Joseph Paul Franklin, to whom Hunter was dedicated. This is from a New York Times story of April 14th of 2014. It's by Steve Yachino, Y-A-C-C-I-N-O, and Dan Barry, B-A-R-R-Y. "Bullets, Blood, and Then Cry of Adolf Hitler." Skipping down, it reads in part, "In recent years, Mr. Miller has also been a devoted pen pal to incarcerated white supremacists, among them Joseph Paul Franklin, a convicted murderer who was executed in Missouri in November. Ms. Beirich, B-E-I-R-I-C-H, of the Southern Poverty Law Center, said that Mr. Miller was very close to Joseph Paul Franklin, whose birthday was on Sunday, the day of the shooting." What it appears to be here, what the shooting appears to be, if in fact Fraser Glenn Miller was the killer, he has not been convicted, so we have to say alleged, but there certainly appears to have been some very strong eyewitness evidence, and he was arrested on the spot. We are looking at a manifestation of the leaderless resistance strategy. That is the strategy in which doctrine can be propagated by Nazi and white supremacist groups advocating just this sort of thing, although because of the possibility of infiltration by law enforcement, of the acolytes of the Nazi and white supremacist ideology are to operate individually or in very small cells and use the publicly propagated documents as ideological motivators. Indeed, William Luther Pierce was very explicit about the fact that Hunter, which deals with an assassin who goes around killing people of color and interracial couples, this was dedicated to Joseph Paul Franklin, who did just that. He killed two African-American men, and he also shot interracial couples as well. And I would also note again, reminding people that the Fraser Glenn Miller was a correspondent, apparently quite close, to the incarcerated Joseph Paul Franklin. Earlier this year, Joseph Paul Franklin was executed in the state of Missouri for his murders. Now, in the Southern Poverty Law Center's profile of Fraser Glenn Miller, we find the following, skipping down. He, too, was someone who was well acquainted with the order. Skipping down, "The Southern Poverty Law Center lawyers did not know it at the time, but Fraser Glenn Miller had ties to the order, a white nationalist terrorist organization whose members assassinated Denver talk show host Alan Berg just 13 days after the SPLC filed suit against Miller. The leader of the group, Robert Matthews, had given Miller $200,000 in cash that was part of the $3.8 million stolen during an armored car robbery. It was later revealed that Morris Dees, the founder of the SPLC, was at the top of the order's hit list. Miller testified in the 1988 trial of other white supremacists that Matthews told him, quote, they were thinking about killing, unquote, Dees." And skipping down still further in this story, "In 1987, while still out on bond, Miller disappeared and went underground. He mailed a declaration of war, unquote, to supporters, exhorting, quote, Aryan warriors of the order to, quote, kill our enemies, and established a point system for each kill. The targets were, quote, one, niggers, two, white race traitors, three, Jews, four, judges, five, Morris Seligman D's, unquote. He signed the statement, Glenn Miller, loyal member of the order. And again, one of the points that I made in For the Record 754 and in other discussion of Glenn Greenwald as an attorney, again, he was something of a fellow traveler for elements like this, doing legal representation for them, mostly for free. And what he was doing specifically was defending them against civil suits that had been filed for advocating acts that had apparently resulted, well, certainly there were acts of violence, both murder and other lethally intended attacks against people of color. And when civil suits were filed against some of these groups, including the National Alliance, whose books, published by National Vanguard Books, are specifically intended as teaching tools, Greenwald successfully defended them against civil litigation. This is not criminal prosecution, but against civil litigation. What Greenwald was doing was running a legal interference for the leaderless resistance strategy, and that is exactly what we appear to be seeing in connection with the attacks in Kansas. I also wonder, parenthetically, about the order, again, the group headed by Bob Matthews, as possibly a money laundering vehicle to transfer underground Reich/Bormann money from Latin America to American so-called neo-Nazis. I don't like the term neo, they're just the next generation, for acts like this. Certainly the order engaged in armored car robberies. I wonder if perhaps that might have served as something of a cover for transfer from Latin America. I would also note that Frazier Glenn Miller is a big fan of Ron Paul. Ron Paul was Edward Snowden's presidential candidate of choice. Edward Snowden's first attorney was Ron Paul's chief legal advisor in his 2012 campaign. And Ron Paul and his son Rand Paul, currently being championed, by the way, by Ralph Nader, are unabashed in their alliances with white supremacists, including elements that feel the South was right in the Civil War, advocate a new secession by the Southern states, and generally justify slavery. Mother Jones' website has an audio file called Listen. Alleged Kansas gunman Frazier Glenn Miller discusses the Tea Party, Obama, and Ron Paul by Tim Murphy and Dana Liebelson, L-I-E-B-E-L-S-O-N. This is from Mother Jones of April 14th of 2014. It, in part, is, in the 2010 radio interview, Frazier Glenn Miller, the man suspected of killing three people Sunday at a Jewish community center and a Jewish retirement center in Kansas, said he was interested in the Tea Party voice support for then-Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and spoke approvingly of Ron Paul, the Texas Republican congressman and presidential candidate. Skipping down, Miller said, Ron Paul is the only independent politician or representative in Washington, and in parenthetically, of whom he approved. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 793, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates, being recorded on May 18th of 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.